Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Thursday, January 12th, 2012. I am your host, Greg Luca, and I am joined by two writers who like to party rock with Trey Burton. We have Matt Watts.
I don't even know what to say to that. I don't even know.
And from florida.scout.com/fightindigators.com, we have Cody Cheesequake Jones.
That is my nickname that we just decided about 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's a good one. Cheesequake. It's like cheesecake and it's like earthquake. It's a good one. It's good.
I'm a big fan, actually. I kind of gave it to myself, so I don't know if that disqualifies it, but
no, it's
I'm
cool.
All in favor of
it's
it.
It's cool.
No, all right. I mean, how can you get a better nickname than Cheesequake?
I know. It's hard to top.
It's unbeatable. Anyway, on today's show.
Bingo.
On today's show, we're going to break down the Florida football season. We haven't come to you guys in a while with some football stuff, so we will take a look at the big picture season as a whole. We will recap the Gator Bowl. We'll start off with some of the news. Obviously, the Brent Peace hire to be the new offensive coordinator. Jeff Demp's going to pursue a track career. And then at the end, we're going to kind of look ahead to next year, talk about some of the guys who are returning, touch a little bit on recruiting. It's going to be a big football show. If you have any feedback, be sure to send that to podcast@alligator.org, and I guess we'll just get right into it. It's another long one today. All right, obviously we have a lot of football stuff to get caught on, but we'll start with some of the big news, some of the most recent stuff, and that's that Brent Pease has been hired as the offensive coordinator. Just a little bit of background on him. He's been coaching for 21 years. He spent the last six at Boise State. Last year he was their offensive coordinator, and before that he was their assistant head coach and wide receivers coach for 5 years. He was also offensive coordinator at Montana, Northern Arizona, Kentucky, and Baylor. And the things that he seems to specialize in is last year, their offense ranked number 8th nationally and was great in the red zone and scored a lot of touchdowns, which was something that's important because Florida really struggled to get touchdowns in the red zone last season. So I guess, first of all, I'll just get your guys' reactions to this. Do you think, is this the hire you expected? Do you think this is the right move by Muschamp and the staff?
I'm not sure that I expected it, but I'm not sure that it's a bad move either. I think it's a pretty good move. You look at Boise State and what they've been able to do, maximizing talent. You know, you don't see the big 5-star, 4-star commits going out to Idaho to play for Boise State. Chris Peterson and his staff has made a name for themselves by maximizing their talent with scheme and smart play calling to get the most out of their players. And I think that's a smart move for Florida because obviously they didn't do that this year.
I think the hire itself is pretty good. I think that's kind of what everybody would agree with, and that it's pretty good. It's above average. But I feel like it was kind of a weak market. There wasn't a lot of guys out there that made out like a home run type, a big splash guy for this offense. And that's kind of what I felt like with this. He is obviously a really good scheme guy. My only worry is that he only was the offensive coordinator there for 1 year, but he's been under Chris Peterson, I believe, since 05 or 06. So he knows a lot about that scheme. He knows a lot about what he's doing. And that's something Muschamp talked about a lot yesterday, is that they use a lot of multiple formations, a lot of just motioning guys, just trying to confuse the defense while not adding a whole lot to your offense to the player. So I think that kind of makes it a little bit different and gives defenses a lot more to prepare for. But again, I think he'll do a lot better job of just getting these Florida guys in the right spots to make plays.
Yeah, the thing that gets me about this a little bit is I'm sure he knows his stuff and he's been doing this for a long time and he must have picked up a lot of great things while he was at Boise, but I don't know how much of the credit for that offense goes to him and how much of it goes to Chris Peterson. And how much you can really expect him to change things out here? Because I don't know like where the offensive genius is in that whole Boise equation.
Right. I think that it's all Chris Peterson as far as the Boise equation goes. And I think that him only being a coordinator at Boise for 1 year might actually be a benefit because he's not going to be entrenched into that mindset. He's going to be able to adapt to what Muschamp wants him to adapt to, but also bring those wrinkles with him. I don't think that you're going to see a complete transformation of Florida's offense into Boise State. I think you're just going to see a lot more motion, a lot more misdirection, a lot more tempo in the offense, and a lot more scheme as opposed to kind of what you saw this year.
All right. And he also was the offensive coordinator at Kentucky and Baylor.
Right.
He wasn't running his Boise scheme or anything like that. He was just kind of running a pro-style offense. And I think that's what you'll see a little bit more of here. And that's kind of what Muschamp alluded to yesterday, saying, one guy learned the playbook, not a whole new 40 guys trying to figure something out. So I think it's going to look a lot the same. But maybe have a little of those Boise wrinkles in there.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that he was at Kentucky for 2 or 3 years, and I think throughout the process of hiring a staff and even the hiring of Muschamp, they've always looked for guys that have that SEC connection and have either that or an NFL connection, and I think that him being at Kentucky for however long that was another factor that they liked. When you think about some of the other names they considered, guys like Kerwin Bell or Brian Schottenheimer, did you think either of those would have been a, or I mean, compared to what we know about Pease?
I think I like the Pease hire more than those two. I think there's a lot more questions with the Bell thing. Obviously, I think a lot of the fan base wanted him just because of his Florida connections here, but I think there would have been a lot more change. Obviously, he would have been in here running his offense. It would have been another year learning a brand new scheme. And also, I think this is kind of like, obviously, Muschamp's not on the hot seat or anything, saying anything like that at this point, but I think this is obviously a big hire for him because he wants to have a big input on this offense. And this is going to be the guy that's either going to make his offense pretty good or maybe even take him down eventually. So he wanted to be really involved with that. He wanted to have an offense that he was familiar with, being this pro-style type thing. So I think that makes a little more sense. Schottenheimer was a guy that maybe could have done it, but I don't think he's been in the college game for a long time. And just from a recruiting standpoint, I don't think I would have really liked that hire too much either.
I kind of agree with you, but we gotta recognize the fact that Schottenheimer's a Florida boy too, and there wasn't that big outcry for him. I don't get that. Everybody has a fan favorite, Kerwin Bell, but nobody jumped on the Schottenheimer bandwagon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think Pease was the right hire out of those three. I think that, you know, having the experience with the SEC, although it was in the early 2000s, it's kind of a different league now. You're still familiar with what goes on. You're familiar with the teams. You're familiar with, you know, going to those stadiums. Nothing's going to be a new feeling for you.
I feel like his history recruiting the state of Florida will be a benefit, as well as his past developing wide receivers and quarterbacks. I mean, to not have to bring in a separate quarterbacks coach is big. To tutor Driscoll and Brissett, who are obviously, you know, need some polishing, to say it kindly. And, you know, you look at Austin Pettis and Titus Young, two guys that were drafted in the top three rounds of the NFL draft. And Titus Young is, you know, making a name for himself in Detroit right now. If you look at Florida's offense this past year, the main thing that they struggled with was getting the ball to the receivers, whether that was Brantley, whether that was the offense, whether it was Weiss, whatever it was, the receivers struggled. So to have a guy that has that history and a track record of being able to develop receivers is only going to be a benefit.
Right, and I think when you talk about having familiarity with recruiting in the state of Florida, when you're coming in at this point with only a month until signing day, not even, to have at least a little bit of something to go on and not having to learn all of this on the fly should be a big benefit to him. One thing I want to talk about is we mentioned that Boise State runs a lot of motion in their offense, a lot of pre-snap stuff. Other than that sort of just cosmetic sort of change, what do you think we're going to see differently from a play-calling standpoint? How much do you think it'll be different from what they did this year under Weiss?
I don't think it'll be too much different. I think they'll maybe this Boise offense, I think that was one of the complaints that Boise fans had about him this past year, is he didn't attack downfield too often. I think he's kind of maybe a pass-happy guy. He likes throwing the ball, but I don't think he really likes stretching the field too much. So I think you maybe see some of those shorter throws a little bit. And to be honest, I think that's probably what this offense is best built for at this point. They don't have a guy that's a great vertical threat, unless you say maybe DeBose a little bit, but even then there's some inconsistencies there. So I think they might be built a little bit better for that, and it's something that I think Boise did a little bit more this year.
And they're good in their scheme in getting receivers open without having them, you know, having to beat a guy one-on-one. You know, kind of like Wes Welker has so much success in New England. He doesn't do it because he's a great athlete. I mean, he's a great athlete, sure, but he's not Calvin Johnson. He's not Randy Moss. He's not just going to beat you with his ability. He beats you because Belichick puts him in motion, gets him in the slot, and gets him on a linebacker, gets him on a mismatch. And I think that's the key, is getting your playmakers mismatched on a linebacker, and that's something that he does really well.
Right. And another thing to think about with this is, if we go back to the beginning of the year, starting off the season, we lose it in the shuffle of everything that's happened. But it was Brantley's job, and then Driscoll was supposed to be number two as the top-rated quarterback prospect. Then Brissett came in all because of Charlie Weiss, and he recruited him as soon as he got here, and that was a purely Charlie Weiss get. And at some point in the year, you know, Brissett passes Driscoll, and we feel like a lot of that has to do with how much Weiss likes him. So now that we have a whole new coordinator coming into Florida, I think it kind of starts those guys back at square one. And I know there was going to be a competition already. It wasn't set in stone. But I think this is even more so wide open now because there's a new coordinator. I mean, you guys agree with me on that?
Yeah, completely.
The biggest winner in this is Jeff Driscoll. I can't imagine how happy he and his family were when Weiss announced that he was leaving, just because now he actually has a fair shot at this job. I don't think it publicly was announced, but it pretty much was decided, I think, behind closed doors that Brissett was at least the guy, unless he had a horrible spring or something like that. So this gives Driscoll a fair shot now at this job.
I agree completely. You could see it at the end of the FSU game. As the stands were cleared out, the FSU band was playing the war chant, Seminole players were going buck wild on the sidelines. Brissett was one of the last players to walk off the field with Charlie Weiss hobbling with his cane, and he stops Brissett, puts his arm over his shoulder, and points to the band and whispers in his ear, and, you know, you can tell it was something like, remember this, you're going to be the guy going forward type of deal. You know, you could, he may not have said you're going to be the guy going forward, but that was the message of that act. So I agree with you completely. The best thing to happen for Driscoll was while he's leaving.
And the thing that got me about that moment, and that's one that stuck out to me too as we were leaving the field there, it made me feel like Charlie Weiss was going to be around. When I found out he was going to Kansas, that was a total shocker to me. I mean, it must have taken you guys by surprise as well.
I'm definitely, because he sat in front of us at a press conference 2 weeks prior and answered five, I think, or six questions and asking about whether he was going to leave and his health and his family and all this. He says, I'm here. I'm committed. I want to stay at Florida. And then 2 weeks later, he's in Kansas. So.
Yeah, huge shock. And I think it just kind of – this is probably a different podcast, but it just kind of proves that no coach really tells the truth ever.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like he almost intended to stay, but I don't think he anticipated he was getting a head coaching offer from anywhere after what they did this year.
That's true.
Like, how do you not jump on that? But anyway, that about wraps up the P stuff. Another bit of little news that came out just today right before we started doing this is that Jeff Demps is apparently going to pursue his track career with hopes of sprinting in the Olympics rather than trying to go for the NFL. I mean, to me, it seems like a good move. He did not do a lot this year on the field, has always been had a little struggles with injuries, and even when he did play and at times played well, it seemed like it was just because he's fast, and in the NFL, he's not that much faster than everybody else. I think this is the best move for his future.
I think we all agree about that, too. It's kind of he made a career out of beating up on the 1AA teams, the Kentuckys and Vanderbilts of the SEC, the teams that he had noticeably more speed than. And he really did make a good career out of that, and he had a lot of success here. He was good at what he did. He was a good kickoff returner when he's given chances to do that. But he's kind of limited. His ceiling as an NFL running back, I think, is limited just because he doesn't have the vision that you need to have there. And I don't really know if there is maybe even a little niche for him in the NFL just because you've got some kickoff guys that have a lot better vision than him, too.
I agree completely. That was my main knock on him, was his vision. You know, he always, for as much as, you know, everybody else talked about him being the straight-ahead, pounded guy, he never wanted to find a hole in the middle of the line. He always wanted to bounce it outside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, I think you summed it up perfectly, he made a living on beating up on Kentucky. Like that, and that was Jeff Demps' career. Sure, he was great, like you said, in some situations, but he was never going to be that guy in the NFL. I'm not even sure he would have been drafted. So this makes complete sense. Not only is he going to have a chance to run in the Olympics, it's a down kind of, you know, environment and track right now. There's only one guy at the top, and then it's kind of an open field after that. He's beaten two of the guys that are tops in the league, or tops in the world behind, Usain Bolt. And he stands to make more money in endorsements and signing contracts there than he does playing in the NFL. I don't see how he could have made any other decision. And I'm just kind of upset that he lied to us at the beginning of the year.
right. And, like, he's fast as hell right now, but if he gets out of football shape and loses a little bit of that football weight and gets into sprinter shape, he could be even faster, which is a scary thought.
Yeah, because since he's been in Florida, his fastest times were when he first came here before he started putting on that bulk. Once he's been in football weight since he's been here, he has not run the same fast times. So whether it's age, whether it's weight, we're about to find out.
Yeah. All right, so to kick this in reverse a little bit, we can talk a little bit about the Gator Bowl. Just a couple – if Florida won, I mean, it is what it is. Finish 7-6. You don't have a losing record. That's good for them. Some quick stats. Brantley was 12 of 16 for 132 yards, a touchdown and an interception. Rainey ran for 71 yards. Demps ran for 30. They sacked Braxton Miller 6 times, and to me, the difference in the game was just special teams. I mean, this game could have gone either way. It was close till the end, but Florida's ability to get the punt block touchdown and the kickoff return touchdown were the difference in the game, in my opinion. And without that, maybe the defense looks dominant the way they played, and the offense looks like it was pretty okay, and they ran the ball well, but to me, it's special teams, and that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to agree completely there, because I mean, Ohio State isn't exactly a powerhouse this year. Their offense, I mean, I think there was quite a few games where they barely got over 10 points per game. It was kind of, you know, the bad versus the worst in that game. And I agree completely. It was the special teams. But you got to give the defensive line a little bit of credit, too. 6 sacks. That's something that you wanted to see throughout the year and you never did see, was them get penetration, affect the quarterback, and make that a different game for them. And, you know, that was good to see at least.
Yeah, winning obviously makes everybody feel better about everything. I think the coaches and players feel a lot better about the end of the season. But there still are a lot of issues, especially on that offense, I think really kind of showed themselves. Now, how much will that improve with Brantley gone and whoever being the starting quarterback next year? I think you could make an argument maybe both ways a little bit for that at this point. But I think just kind of a fresh start, at least at that quarterback position, is probably the best thing this offense could ask for.
Yeah, and then you could tell by the empty stands that there's not a lot to read into just this game, and the interest in it wasn't that high. But I do want to talk about anything we noticed that kind of stood out to us that's going to be something we could spin forward to next year and gives us a little bit of insight on what that's going to be like. And for me, it was how heavily they kind of rely on Demps and Rainey and on offense. Rainey was the leading receiver again. He was the leading rusher, obviously. Demps had the majority of the rest of their rushing yards, and I'm not sure how they're going to move the ball without those two next season because they've been the focal point all year, and so that's something that I would be concerned about if I was Florida, just looking at that game and trying to spin it forward.
Yeah, I mean, the whole offense has to be a concern. Who are your playmakers now? Like, who are they? You know, you want to say that you have an offense predicated on running the football. Well, you don't have a line that can open up holes. And your number one running back next year is going to be Mike Gillisley, who you didn't trust to put on the field for the majority of the season. So I don't understand. And then you look at the receiver position. Who do you have? Quentin Dunbar?
Right.
Craig Hammond? Cool. I mean, Juwan Story, redshirt this year. He's supposed to be a pretty dynamic guy. I mean, Andre DeBose is a playmaker for sure, but he's not consistent. He had 16 catches on the year, something like that. That's not enough. I don't see... Like you said, how are they going to move the ball? How are they going to score points? I just don't see it.
Yeah, I agree. Looking at the defense a little bit, and the thing that, and this is, again, kind of a little off the wall here, but I was really impressed with the way that John Bostic played. I know he kind of struggled a little bit this year just in kind of getting off blocks and actually being a run stopper in the middle. I kind of made this up a little bit, but I think he would be a great fit at buck position for them. I really think he's a guy that can maybe get off, at least come off the edge a little bit better if you want to move Ronald Powell down to a defensive end spot and just kind of see what he can do. I think that's something I'd toy around with a little bit and just try to see because he actually did get into the backfield a little bit. Side to side, I feel like he's pretty solid back there. So I was actually impressed with him for the first time, I think, in quite a while, actually.
I agree with you there. I mean, for the beginning of the year, he said it was his first time really blitzing as a linebacker. And he looked really good in that area at times this season. So to give him a full season, another off season, and, I mean, why not? Yeah. Ronald Powell didn't show you enough there. Why not? Why not try Bostic at that position? Why not?
I'd flip them, actually. I think I'd put Powell at middle linebacker and just kind of tell him to just stop the run up the middle every time.
I don't think he can do that.
He probably couldn't, but he couldn't be worse than what he's doing now.
That's fair.
I mean, you could put him in a middle slot with the 3-4 and let him, you know, just run sideline and make plays. I think that might be a better situation for him than trying to hold the edge and, you know, be a run stopper in the run game as well as get pressure on the quarterback off the edge because, you know, we just didn't see that. Cool. Even though he led the team in sacks with 6, he was not consistent, and at least 3 of those were coverage sacks.
At least, like, 9 of them were. Yeah. Like, I didn't see him, like, actually put on a good move and get to the quarterback.
Edge,
yeah.
Blew up the left tackle and sacked the quarterback not once. You didn't see that from any defensive end.
Yeah, just to not get too far away, I'm not sure I agree with you guys on the Bostic at the buck position kind of thing because I don't know about what he did in high school, but I think what they like about the buck guys is that they've kind of played some linebacker and some defensive end, so they have the ability to kind of be the guy who runs sideline to sideline and makes tackles against the run. But they also have those kind of like swim move, club move, counter move, pass rush ability kind of stuff that I don't know if Bostic has that. And when he's gotten sacks this year and gotten pressure, it's different when the offensive line isn't sure whether you're coming or not. So yeah. I'm not 100% sure on that, but they need to try something to get a better pass rush.
Right, that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Right. He actually played safety a little bit in high school, so that would probably prove your point a little bit more. But, I don't know, just something I was thinking about.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, to kind of go a little bit broader, we now know that they finished the year 7-6, and I don't know that any of us came into the season with that high of expectations for them, but would you say this is better or worse or about what you expected?
I think it was about what I expected. I think we talked about it at the beginning of the year, and I think we put the ceiling at 8 wins. I think that was... You know, I don't think anybody expected them to go above 8 wins. So to come in at 7-6 was pretty much expected. I'm just not sure that the way they got to 7-6 was expected.
That's true. I agree with that. I think I was kind of expecting 8 wins coming in. I felt like that was a pretty safe bar. You maybe could say they still should have. I still think they should have won that Auburn game. And looking at the box score and like looking at the way that game went, I still can't really figure out how they lost that one.
Right. But,
Yeah, I guess that'll probably do it. I think Matt kind of hit the nail on the head here. It's definitely about what it was expected, but it was a lot uglier than expected. It was really kind of just a bizarre year.
Right. The thing is that before the season, I said 6-6, and it worked out that way, but I don't feel good about it because I still don't know what would have happened if Brantley never gets hurt. Like, you don't beat Alabama and you don't beat LSU, but maybe if he's not limited against Auburn and Georgia, maybe that works out totally differently. So... And when I look at this, when I look at it after 4 games, how good they were in the first 4 games of the season, it's hard to imagine that that's the same team that finished 6-6. Something changed along the way. So that's why at that point I was kind of questioning it, and then it's just totally different at the end.
I agree with you. I hate to do those hypotheticals, but you kind of have to with, you know, when your starting quarterback goes down, especially the way he looked in that first half against Alabama, minus the Courtney Upshaw pick six. That was the best John Brantley ever looked in his career at Florida. And, you know, I kind of agree with you there. I think the Auburn game goes a little bit differently. Should Brantley be in there, they're obviously going to be able to move the ball a little bit more. Auburn was terrible this year. So there's got to be a way that they put up more than 6 points in that game. But I think that the main problem for this team all year was the offense's, you know, propensity to turn the ball over inside their own end. And that was what really did them in.
That's fair. I think it's interesting because when we came into the year, it seemed like the biggest concern about Florida was the secondary and how little we knew about those guys and how inexperienced they all were. And that turned out to be a pretty pleasant surprise. But overall, the inability to move the ball was just, I mean, there's nothing you could do to overcome that.
Right. I think in the beginning of the year, we were looking at the secondary and the offensive line. And I think the secondary proved us wrong, and the offensive line proved us extremely wrong.
The offensive line lived down to expectations for sure. All right, I want to do a little bit like we did yesterday with the basketball show. We picked out the best win and talked about what went right, and then picked out the worst loss and talked about what went wrong. Just to kind of give you an idea as listeners of what they need to do to play at their best and what goes wrong when they play at their worst. So we'll start with the positive, and for me it was Kentucky. And I know it's Kentucky, but when you go on the road and you win by 38 points, that's pretty impressive anyway. And it was basically a sign that we talk about the offensive line as a big concern. Kentucky's defensive line didn't have any players that could give them trouble. And that's why Florida was able to move the ball and able to run it as well as they did, averaging like 9 yards a carry and running for 400 or something stupid like that. And the defense wasn't really tested, and they played as well as they usually have. So that's a sign that when you can actually not have your offensive line get totally dominated, this is a pretty good team that Florida was. But there's just too many defensive lines in the SEC that just completely overpowered them.
I'm going to take the Ohio State game. I know it's kind of a cop-out all game right. That we just talked about, but I really think that is kind of the best win, the best way this team's played all year. They had the takeaways on defense. They had the sacks. The offense certainly turned the ball over still and was definitely an issue. But kind of, I don't know, they're at least somewhat functional, which is a lot better than they were in recent games before that. So I think that was okay. And then special teams, I think they're going to need that again next year to score points. They're going to need special teams to kind of turn the field over a little bit and steal some points here and there.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I'm not sure you can give them a good win from this season.
Yeah, right. That's the bottom line.
when you look at it, Florida Atlantic, UAB, Tennessee, Kentucky,
Vanderbilt and Furman.
Vanderbilt and Furman. Like, those are the games you're expected to win. I mean, Ohio State is a little bit of a toss-up because it's Ohio State end of the year or whatever.
They were the favorite, though.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah.
So, I don't know if you can give them a good win. I just don't.
Well, I think one thing that it's fun to talk about is that the key strain between my win and Cody's win and other games where they played well is that they just let Brantley be a game manager and the run game was able to dominate and the defense did its thing. That was how they were successful this year. And in the games that they lost, which we'll talk about right now, I don't know if you guys have a pick, but mine was FSU. And that was where they couldn't get the run game going, so then Brantley had to try to do a little bit more, and the quarterbacks ended up throwing as many yards to their guys as they did to the other teams, and Florida State didn't have to move the ball. That game was also emblematic because Florida State didn't even hit 100 yards of offense, I don't think, in that one.
Right,
but
exactly.
Because the offense was just so inept, it was kind of what we've seen all year, where if you can't move the ball even a little bit, it doesn't matter how well your defense plays because you can't put up points and win games.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. That was definitely the worst loss for me, and it kind of exemplified the point I said earlier about the offense and their main problem being turning the ball over and setting up the other team for easy scores. You saw that with Florida State. They didn't have 100 yards of offense. I don't think it was, what was the stat? Like, it had been 100 years or something that a team had won a college football game without 100 yards of offense.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to do.
That's absurd. So, I mean, I'm sure we've said that's absurd. We've gone over that a ton, but that's the worst loss for me, without a doubt.
Hands down, the Florida State offense is the worst loss. I think South Carolina's up there a little bit. Auburn is, too. I think South Carolina's in there, though, just because the defense couldn't get them off the field. And that was kind of an issue for them all seasons. They couldn't create turnovers. South Carolina just run these – they kept running these little read plays where Connor Shaw would just kind of go – I think he ran for 93 yards or something, which when a Spurrier quarterback, like, really?
Right.
So that was kind of a little bizarre too. So I think just from a defensive perspective, for as well as they played, I think that kind of exemplified the season that they had, that they just couldn't get anybody off the field.
And that kind of bleeds into my next thing I wanted to talk about was, is the defense as good as the numbers suggest? They ended the year number 8 in total defense, allowing 299 yards a game, number 40 in rush defense at 132.7 yards a game, and number 6 in pass defense with 166.8 yards per game. And that's nationally. They were top 10 defense. But watching the games, it didn't seem like they were that good. What led to that disparity? Or, I mean, do you guys feel the same way, that it's not as strong as the numbers seem to show it is?
It's turnovers. And I mean, I think that's got to be what it is. They couldn't create those. They couldn't even really get sacks to put the offense behind the chains and force a punt. So I think it was kind of a bend but don't break defense a little bit, but then there were times where they would still break too. Like I think I measure it when you look at a game like Alabama or LSU, when they're facing a team that isn't a great offense but is going to control line of scrimmage, and they basically did whatever they want. Both those two teams did. Florida couldn't stop them either way. Alabama and LSU just ran all over them, did really whatever they wanted to. And that's kind of how I judge a defense, is how they do against the better opponents that they're facing.
I agree. I think Florida kind of laid down in some of their games against the bigger teams. You know, they pulled out that wildcat package and just tried to run the clock out. And it just seemed like they were tucking their tail between the legs and saying, let's get this over with as quick as we can. We know we don't have a chance here. And another thing with the – I mean, I'm kind of, you know, beating a dead horse here, but when your offense turns the ball over – inside the road into the field, the other team's offense doesn't have to go that far to score. So you're not going to put up many yards, not going to put up many points. So that's another thing that goes into it. There's a lot of factors that go into it. I think the defense was dominant at times against inferior opponents, but against the better teams, like you said, they didn't hold their own. And a part of that was the turnovers. They did not create enough. They just didn't.
And I think that kind of inflated the stats a little bit, too. As far as the pass defense goes, I think it just kind of proved that you could run really on this team. If you had a good running game, you could run pretty much on them as much as you want.
That's why the pass defense was exactly the nation, because everybody ran on Florida.
And everybody got big leads early. There's Alabama, LSU, South Carolina. So there was really no need for a lot of those teams to even throw to begin with.
Exactly.
All right. I'm trying to find the number here. Okay, I have it. In the 8 SEC games, the Gators, I crunched some numbers on this, the Gators only held their opponents an average of 19 yards below what their offense is average otherwise. I think kind of the point of that is they didn't play a team that ranked higher than 30 in total offense, and that was Alabama. Aside from them, they didn't play a team that ranked higher than 75.
Wow.
So they just played a lot of teams that don't move the ball, and that kind of leads to you not getting the ball moved on you a lot. And then, on top of all the other stuff that you guys said, which is key too. Before we move off defense, I think it would be interesting to kind of go over what you guys think are the defensive MVPs of this team if we have a top three. I know I kind of laid out mine, but I'd like to hear what you guys have in mind.
Cody, lead us off.
I'm going to go number one. I think Matt Elam had the best season on that defense.
I mean, that's who I put, too.
I feel fairly strong about that, but I don't really know who I would have had it at two or three. Just because Elam's like one of the better tacklers on the team, probably should have had a couple more picks that he dropped. As far as number two, that's a tough one. Maybe Jay Howard, I guess, a little bit. It's kind of tough because Florida's run defense wasn't really that good, but he was probably, I guess, their most consistent pass rush threat, I guess, which probably says more about their pass rush than anything. But he was pretty solid this year.
And I had Jay Howard as my number two as well.
Really?
Let's see if you could go 3 for 3.
My number three is going to be Marcus Roberson.
Yeah.
Because I think just based on expectations, being a freshman corner, he absolutely did a lot better than I think really anybody could have expected. And the numbers really aren't that great, but I think that's a little deceptive just when you're talking about a corner who's
right. You see a lot of good
job,
corners
so.
don't get thrown on a lot, exactly. Don't get a lot of tackles, stuff like that. And I think that's what Roberson was. The injury definitely hurt him, but I actually had Bostic number three. To backtrack a little bit, I think with Elam, and I know Matt Watts is not a big Matt Elam fan.
I'm still going to give Matt Elam number one because he honestly had the biggest impact on that defense. I mean, as much as I don't think that Matt Elam is, you know, worthy of all the praise that he receives, I think he's more so the standout on a, you know, defense full of kind of mediocre and, you know, not great talent. I think he's probably the best talent on that defense, and he's in a more visible role because of the way that he plays towards the line of scrimmage and the way he makes plays. Sure, I'll give Matt Elam number one, and I got to go Roberson number two, though. Roberson and the job that he did as a freshman, like you said, And, you know, teams shied away from throwing at Marcus Roberson. Every single time that they threw the ball, they picked on either Luchez Purifoy, Jalen Watkins, or Cody Riggs, or whoever else was lined up on the other side. And three, I'm going to go with Easley, Mr. Chucky.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I like Jay Howard, and I like a lot that he did. But, like you said, how can you give a defensive tackle? I mean, I'm obviously giving it to Easley here, but he plays three technique versus Jay Howard playing the one technique. They were terrible against the run. I think Easley provided the biggest impact along that line, so I'm going to give it to him.
Here's my thing with – I think that Easley has a little bit of the Chris Rainey, Jeff Demps thing in him, where because he's quick off the ball and he's fast and he's kind of an athlete, against bad teams he does a lot better than he does against good teams. Like in the games that they lost and some of the games – like the games against like the Alabamas and the LSUs of the world, teams with bigger, stronger offensive lines, I felt like he disappeared a lot because he is sort of an undersized player.
He is sort of an undersized player, and I agree with that. But – you know, did you see Jay Howard stand out in those games?
I mean, I feel like Jay Howard at least made a bunch of tackles every week. Like
Jay Howard was the man on that defensive line. I will say that. He was the only one that tackled Trent Richardson by himself. You know?
Yeah.
That's the standard.
Yeah, that's the standard for sure.
But yeah, like I said, I had Elam number one because when I look at it, what they wanted to do was create turnovers and make big plays, and he led the team with 11 tackles for loss. He tied for the lead with 2 interceptions, which isn't a lot, but he tied for the team lead, and he led the team with 2 forced fumbles, which also isn't a lot. But in terms of making plays and generating turnovers, he was the guy that did that this year, and I think that's why he deserves recognition as the best there. To move over to the offensive side, those numbers aren't quite as good. They were number 105 in total offense out of, 120 teams maybe?
Yes, 120.
With 328.7 yards per game, number 89 in pass offense with 184, and number 73 in rush offense at 143. So who takes the blame for that?
Everyone? I think some people would say Urban Meyer, but...
Really? Okay.
Not me, though. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I think Brantley gets a majority of the blame.
Really? Because I feel like they were so much better when he was in there. Like the first.
Yeah, but what does that really mean, though? How good were they with him in there?
True. True. I mean, for me, I think it's the offensive line.
That's true.
In terms of both aspects being so bad.
Yeah, I think you got to go with the offensive line. There was not holes to run through for the running backs, and there wasn't time to pass for the quarterbacks. So,
right.
How can you succeed on offense? Like everybody anywhere always says about football, it starts in the trenches. If you can't win the line of scrimmage, you don't have, you know, a chance in hell of competing against good teams.
Yeah.
So you got to look there. You just have to look there. When Matt Patchen and Xavier Nixon are your, you know, best options at tackle outside of Chaz Green, you're going to have problems. You know, concussion-laden 26-year-old Dan Winger transfers for his 6-year college and starts. Yeah, you've got problems. John Jalapio, who was a 3-star recruit who I thought was absolutely terrible last year, he's your best offensive lineman. That says it all. That's just what it is.
Wasn't it Alajajian and Coney at tackle at the end of the Ohio State game?
Yes.
Yeah,
that really might say it all.
It's a real problem area, and I don't know about the recruiting class, or I don't know about. There's a couple guys that missed this season and are going to redshirt. Maybe there's some help out there. They better hope so because Nixon and Patchen aren't the answers for sure.
Well, they had Tripp Thurman, Tommy Jordan, both had shoulder surgeries and missed this year, and then they've got two pretty big name recruits coming in, and Jessamyn Dunker and DJ Humphries.
Yeah, we can talk about where they fit in when we get into the depth chart a little bit, but to kind of wrap up the overall season recap, we did the defensive MVPs. I want to talk about the offensive MVPs. I got it started with Brantley because, as we've been talking about, I mean, even against Alabama, they were competitive when he was in there, and I know that wasn't going to last and they weren't going to win that game, but when you saw the drop off from Brantley playing to the next guy, I think it's hard to debate what he really means to this offense. I don't know if you guys feel the same way about putting him at number one.
I'm not sure I'd put him at number one, but he would be in the top three just because of that reason you said that. I mean, they weren't good with him in there, but they were really, really, really bad without him. So I'm not sure whether that merits MVP status or not, but it deserves recognition at least for his ability to kind of make plays.
to look back on it properly, he threw for 185 yards a game, 11 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, which is better than last year, but not great at all by any stretch. But they want him to be a game manager. They were never going to ask him to do too much, even if he was playing better. The stats wouldn't look that great, so it's hard to say.
Cody, where does Brantley fit in the MVP picture for you?
I don't know if he's in my top three. Wow. Just because I don't know. Like, the improvement from Driscoll and Brissett to Brantley, there was improvement. But I don't know if it was, like, good enough to, like talk about how good he or he made the offense. I know that y'all aren't saying that, but just, the, like, I don't know if the improvement deserved that. Like, I think, there, like, Chris Rainey was more important to the offense, I would say.
Chris Rainey's by far my number one.
I had Chris Rainey number two.
Okay, well, I have him easily at number one.
Listeners, I wish you could have seen the look. He just came back.
I would probably have DeBose number two, I think, just because he at least gives you something. Like, he gives you at least a threat, maybe.
Right. DeBose was my third guy. When you look at averaging 27 yards per catch for a team that could hardly move the ball and ending the season as their leading receiver, to be able to provide a big play and put a couple points on the board might be all you need with this defense. So I think that's where a lot of his value lies. So I can agree with that selection.
Yeah, I think I got to go Rainey, DeBose, Brantley. But I would be very tempted to put somebody like even Hunter Joyer at three over Brantley or A.C. Leonard or Jordan Reed when he was healthy. Maybe any of those guys could have been higher than Brantley for me.
I think Brantley's probably three by default. I'm really trying. Right. I'm pushing for someone. My Jordan Reed love has not died at all, so I really want to put him number three.
The dude had 300 yards receiving this season.
Yeah, I know.
And who was the leading wide receiver and how many did he have? It was DeBose, like 450 on 16 catches.
See, it's interesting how you do it because DeBose had 16 catches for 432, but then Rainey had the most receptions with 31 for 381. And while we're talking about Rainey, also ran for 861 yards, which is not great when you think about we thought he was going to get 1,000 and people thought he could be a lock for – you know, at least 1,000, and people were talking about how him and Demps could both run for 1,000. Demps finished with 569 yards.
How, he missed a few games, though. Yeah.
That's true, but I mean, they weren't going to be close either way.
No, Rainey at 831, he missed a game as well. He missed parts of games with ankle injuries. I think it would have been plausible had he stayed healthy the entire year for him to make 1,000.
Well, he ran for 5 yards a carry, and usually they're above that, aren't they?
Yeah, they both came in averaging 7.
So, I don't know, not a great season for him, but he, like we said, he was the focal point. Most catches, most carries by far. So
he did go backwards a lot this year, though.
That's true. That's true.
He just would have gone at least the line of scrimmage. Maybe he hit it. Who knows?
All right. So then now I guess we hit the part of the show where we start looking forward to next year, and I took the liberty of putting together a depth chart. Like, I'll admit that I don't know a whole lot about recruiting, so this is all about returning players, and I guess rather than read down the whole thing, what do you think are the strongest positions heading into next year? For me, it's the linebacking group, because you know, you're bringing back everybody, and then Jelani Jenkins and John Bostic weren't great, but had pretty nice seasons, and I mean, McCray, I liked, he had some injury issues, but I thought McCray played well when he was out there, and Ronald Powell's terrible, but what are you going to do? Like, I still think that's the strongest unit on the team right now.
For me, it's the secondary, because I think their ceiling is just so much higher. Jelani Jenkins and John Bostic, they're serviceable, they're good players. They're not great. Matt Elam, Marcus Roberson have the potential to be great players. Then you've got, you know, Deontay Saunders, Josh Evans that made, you know, they played their roles, they were good, and they weren't terrible, they didn't get beat that much. But then you also, I mean, I know you don't want to do a bunch of recruiting, but you've got a couple guys coming in, and Marcus May and Brian Poole.
We think.
Right. Possibly. That that could step in and play opposite Marcus Roberson, and even...
Is Cody Riggs getting past that easily?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I like Cody Riggs. He's a pretty good player, but he's just got limitations.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And then I guess you feel the same way about Watkins, and there's no chance Jeremy Brown's healthy next year and is a factor in this whole thing?
That's what I'm saying. You've got so much depth there. You've got so many options that you can put in these younger guys and let them make plays, as well as having the reliability of some of the veterans and some of the other guys. I think the secondary by far will be the strength of the team next year.
I'm a big Jeremy Brown guy, too. If he comes back healthy, I think he could maybe start at that spot. But if not, I like Brian Poole a lot, and I think he's going to start at that spot, and that's getting way ahead of ourselves. But
really?
My unit is tight end.
Of course it's tight end.
It really
is. This is good. This is good.
Because I think Jordan Reed, if he can stay healthy and has another year to learn and just kind of try to figure out that tight end position, his athletic ability is unquestioned. And I like what A.C. Leonard did down the stretch, obviously. He became kind of a factor in this offense and his athletic ability. Plus, Florida has, according to Scout.com, the top two tight ends in the country committed right now coming in next season. One is probably just a sixth offensive lineman, is going to block quite a bit and probably be pretty good at it. I think he alone will probably help this offensive line out immediately.
That's what I was about to say.
Well, what I was going to say is that my big concern with them is that they don't have a true blocker. If that guy's coming in, yeah. I think the Gerald Christian loss was pretty big.
I agree. Mm-hmm. But Ken Taylor and Colin Thompson.
Yeah, Thompson being the bigger guy, yeah. I think he'll help out right away just from that aspect.
Even Ken Taylor's 6'5", yeah. 250, something yeah. like that. So, I mean, you've got two dynamic receiving options in Reed and Leonard, then you could bring these two guys in. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I think Thompson might be, or Kent Taylor, sorry. I think he's closer to 220, 230.
Yeah, I think so.
But he could, I mean, he maybe even could play a little bit receiver. I know he did in the Army game a little bit. So I think that position itself is really solidified for the next couple of years here. And I don't know. I think that kind of makes things easier for a first-year starter, too, to have those guys that you can trust and have really four of them there.
Right.
And they're versatile, which is a good thing for incoming new offensive coordinator Brent Peace, because what Boise like to do a lot was motion and start, you know, a tight end in the backfield and then motion him back out and have the fullback lined up as a tight end, then bring him back in and then run off of that. So you've got, you know, you can have your tight end lined up left of the quarterback and your fullback to the left, and then motion him to the right side of the line and bring your fullback back to the right and then run right. And you completely confuse the defense. You line up power left and then you end up running power right. And I mean, it's those type of plays and that type of versatility that they're going to be able to take advantage of with that much depth at tight end.
Well, I mean, talking about the tight ends and their usefulness and how good they were this year, it kind of spins into my next question, because when I look at the positions that are the biggest weaknesses, one that stands out for me definitely is wide receiver. And if you look at the stats from this year, Jordan Reed had 28 catches for 307 yards. Then the next pass catcher was Thompson with 21 for 264, but he's gone. Then after that, you have DeBose, who we already talked about as a deep threat. And then Hammond was the next best receiver with 15 catches for 181 yards. Now, Leonard didn't play a lot, but when he did, I thought he showed flashes and looked pretty good. Do you guys think that, given the lack of ability at wide receiver, because my starters right now are Quentin Dunbar and Andre DeBose and maybe Frankie Hammond's out there, and then my fourth guy was Jawan Story. Like, there's just, like, not players at this position.
Well, I don't think it's fair to rule out Jawan Story yet. He was a redshirt freshman this year. He didn't play at all. I mean, I don't think we've seen anything from him. I think the jury's still out. You can't just say
Jawan Story's not a player. If he was really good, he'd probably be out there.
That's fair. Maybe. Or maybe they wanted to save him because they know that he's good and they know they didn't have any chance of doing anything this year.
Either way, am I the only one that feels like the passing game is going to have to lean real heavily on the two tight ends?
No, I agree with you there. I'm not trying to say that the receiver position is strong by any means. I'm just saying let's hold on Judge and Jawan Story.
That's fair. Do you guys think it's the weakest as we look at what we have coming back in terms of these returners for Florida?
I think you can maybe argue that. The tough part is you don't know what progression will be made in the spring. I think the offensive line will be better just from another year in the system, another year under Verducci. Because, I mean, this line still is fairly young, at least on the interior part of it. So I think that group will probably get a little bit better. I think it'll be that or wide receiver will probably be the weakest spots there. I think I am with you on that. But, again, DeBose could have a great offseason and actually learn how to become a complete receiver and give them kind of a go-to guy. Dunbar could actually live up to the hype that we've heard about him. I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs that I think it's kind of tough to say here in early January.
Yeah, without a doubt, it's got to be on the offensive side of the ball. And for me, it might even be halfback. It might even be tailback.
That's true, too.
That's another one.
You've got Mike Gillisley as your leading returner. I mean, Gillisley looked good at times this year. And, you know, Boise's had success with Ian Johnson at running back. So,
right.
You know, if there's a chance that the offensive line solidifies, then it might not matter as much who your running back is. They've got a guy named Matt Jones coming in who might be all right. But, again, that's just speculation. You just don't know. And I think the biggest question marks might be at running back, because I don't think the offense is going to be, you know, dependent upon the wide receiver position as much. I don't think that's what Muschamp wants. I don't think that's the way he wants to build his offense, is to depend on wide receivers. Sure, they need to be an integral part of what you do on offense, but I don't think that that's what he wants to, you know, lean on, be known for, depend on.
That's fair. I mean, the thing that Cody mentioned a little while ago is when we try to project improvement, I don't know if I like to do that so much, especially with guys who did not seem to get better as the year went on.
I can agree with you there.
Like, especially on the offensive line. I think I decided in my little projections here that Chaz Green is going to probably start at left tackle and Patchett on the other side with Nixon hopefully on the bench somewhere. All three of them are problems. Do you see it working out the same way as I kind of have it imagined here?
I kind of think Like, I hate to do the speculation thing, but I think DJ Humphries might be a guy that could start.
Who?
You know, DJ Humphries.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably going to come in and be better than anybody else they have on their offense.
I mean, that wouldn't be that difficult if there was a year for it.
Even with, you know, a worse offensive line this year, he still started on the right side the entire year. So I'm not sure he's going to switch to the left and automatically be their dependable blindside blocker for their quarterback. Mm. As DJ Humphries is an athletic, you know, freak. If the way that I hate to, you know, do all this speculation with recruiting and stuff, but he's one of those guys that should he stay healthy and should he ascend on the path that he's on, he'll project to be a top 10 pick in the NFL draft for me.
Nah.
I mean, it's very premature and very silly to say that type of stuff right now. But that's the type of player that they're getting in DJ Humphries.
I have a feeling that a couple years ago, there were people sitting in this room saying those same things about Xavier Nixon.
And they're very similar because they were both touted as athletic guys that are kind of undersized because Humphries right now is only, I think, 240, 245 pounds.
Yeah, I think he's 260, 270.
Okay. The last time I thought I saw some, I thought he was at like 250.
If he's at 250, just give up now.
A little bit, you know, at least for the SEC, without a doubt. But he's, you know, he's got the ceiling there. I mean, sure, you said the same thing about Xavier Nixon. So, like I said, it's silly to project and it's silly to say these type of things. But
until the recruiting podcast starts,
right, there's a possibility that that he could start at left tackle for me in fall.
I think it's the other thing kind of helps him out too is he's already here. Like he's already enrolled. He's going to get in the strength program, which should help him out a little bit. I see him listed at 265 right now.
Okay. Yeah.
But so you add a little bit of weight to him. The other thing I think too is, I guess I'm the only one that really likes Chaz Green a lot. I think he's actually really good.
No, I'm not trying to discredit Chaz Green. I'm just not sure that he's your starting left tackle.
Yeah, I guess that's fair because he was at the right side quite a bit this year.
He's
so
the best tackle on the roster,
right?
Without a doubt.
I like his potential. I think he could be a fairly high draft pick next couple of years if he continues to improve because he's really raw coming out of high school too. And I know that people were a little up and down on him. The rumor was that, and I think this was actually pretty legitimate, was that Pete Carroll thought he was the number one offensive lineman in the country coming out of high school. So they liked him quite a bit, and I know Florida obviously did as well. So I'm pretty high on him, and I think he will progress a little bit better in the future. That tackle spot is a lot better, but now it's just kind of what do you do on the interior there. Harrison and Halapio, I think, are okay. I think they're serviceable. You can get by with them. But that left guard spot is just kind of wide open right now, and I don't really see an answer on this team right now.
Right. They're Harrison and Halapio, they're serviceable, but they're not maulers. You know?
Right.
I mean, they're not road graders. They're not going to open up holes in the running game for you. And, I mean, I think we have to, you know, not forget the fact that Jonathan Harrison was benched towards the end of the year.
Right. For my purposes, I slid Coney up into left guard, just for what it's worth, because I know and he was part of the platoon this year, and didn't seem to embarrass himself any more than any of these other clowns.
He's probably the best.
Right. He's the obvious choice there. Is Winger, he didn't get a seventh year, did he?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. And I also put out the names, you know, Alajazian, Trip Thurman, Tommy Jordan, and Ian Silverman all appear down this depth chart somewhere near the back. And so I don't know what to expect from any of those. Obviously, Thurman and Jordan coming back off injury. Alajazian, there was a sighting during the Gator Bowl. He was somehow figured prominently in this Gator Bowl thing. But I mean, it remains to be seen what happens with those guys going forward.
He talks a big game on Twitter, though, Mr. Alajazian.
I don't know if I follow him. I might have to get on that.
Yeah, he said something about the Seminoles after that game, saying they're so annoying. How long is it until we get to play them again?
Goodness gracious. Right after that loss,
you can't say that after you lose.
Yeah. He was on the bench for the loss. Anyway. One last thing I want to touch on the offensive side of this. I have a couple points on defense. But for offense, when I was putting this together, I had a hard time finding a spot for Trey Burton, and so I invented a position. He's the F-20, which is when it's two backs and three wide receivers, he'll be the fullback. So it's like third and longs where he goes and catches passes or something.
I hate that.
I mean, does he have any other value? Is that like, because
no.
Hunter Joyer's rising.
Yeah, you're right. And Burton really struggled with blocking this year, too, whereas Joyer is fairly solid for a freshman. I don't know where he fits in, to be honest with you. Did they switch him back to safety this year? Like, is that...
Well, the funny
I don't know
thing
where you get him on the field.
The funny thing to me was Weiss said that they were going to try him out at running back, and that was going to be, like, over the offseason, instead of just being a jack-of-all-trades, they would put him in someplace. But, I mean, unless he's going to play running back at Kansas, that really doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I don't think you do that. I think Gillislee and... I think I'm sorry. I'm switching topics here. I think the wild card in all this is Mack Brown. Like, we don't really know what the deal is with him. He hadn't really got on the field.
He's got on the ball.
There you go. I guess that's probably what it is. But he's got a decent build. But can you? I think I'd probably rather have those two guys at quarterback than Burton if I'm the floor staff. Yeah. Yeah. What did I say?
Quarterback.
Okay.
Oh, I would probably rather have too, those. Actually. Yeah.
If we're being real honest.
Good lord. I think anybody that's listened to me on the podcast talk about Trey Burton before knows that I don't even think he's a football player. I don't think he has a right to wear pads. So, yeah, I agree. There's not a spot for him. Hunter Joyer is a beast, and he's going to be the fullback for this team for 3 years. He's, bar none, you know, a prototypical, exactly what you want at fullback. Trey Burton doesn't have a spot. Sure.
And we already talked about the tight ends. He's not as good as those guys,
no,
for sure.
He doesn't have a chance to crack the lineup there. He can't crack the lineup at receiver. He can't crack the line. I mean, running back is probably his best chance. And even then, his only role would probably be as a short yardage back. And his one opportunity of this year in the FSU game, he went for negative 14. What a sneak. So where can you rely on this guy at? Where? I mean, maybe he's making donuts for me. That's about it. Other than that, I'm sorry, Trey Burton, but you can, you know.
Yeah. I think they might keep the Trey Burton Wildcat just because they feel bad for him.
I need to have some function, right?
Hope
not. I mean,
that was awful. I'm done with the whole Wildcat thing.
Yeah, please.
It stopped this offense, which wasn't hard to do, but it like actually stopped this offense completely whenever they had any momentum in the Gator Bowl.
Right. It was like, it was the only way that they could get Burton and Gillislee on the field, because Gillislee like had no idea what was going on otherwise, and
right.
Burton's terrible. And I guess they wanted those guys involved for some reason, and that was the only way they could do it.
In some of their games, it was like their fallback. Like, we can't move the ball with Brantley, Driscoll, or Brissett, so let's try this Wildcat.
And it's
like,
funny.
LSU.
Yeah, exactly. They actually moved the ball against LSU with that package, which was surprising. But, I mean, other than that, I can't think of a time when it actually worked well.
It's funny thinking about it. That was the only time we saw Gillislee, and then when they had the Rainey Wildcat with Omarius Hines on the little sweep, that was the only time we saw Hines either.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to give these guys something to do. All right. Looking over the defensive side a little bit, I laid it out as a 4-3 front, and then I did it again and laid it out as a 3-4 front. And whatever way you look at it, the problem to me is the defensive tackle depth. And I'll admit I don't know about recruiting, but right now the only true kind of penetrating defensive tackle that I saw is Dominique Easley, because you still have to play Floyd at end because you don't have any of those guys either. Like, I think when Floyd played defensive tackle in the Gator Bowl, people were like, wow, Floyd's finally found a spot. He's better here. And that's obviously true, but out of necessity, I don't think he's going to be able to move inside next season unless there's a whole bunch of recruits I don't know about.
Well, they've got, supposedly, they got a commitment from 5-star defensive end Jonathan Bullard at the U.S. Army All-America game last weekend. And he's, what, number 6 or something overall defensive end recruit?
Top 3 on scout, I think. I think he's a number 3 defensive end. He's a top 20 overall player, I think, on both sides. Mm.
And had they got Jordan Jenkins as well, who they missed out on, who went to Georgia, I think that they probably could have got away with moving Floyd inside. But I think likely you're going to see a lot more base 3-4 next year. I think that's going to be out of necessity. They got a JUCO transfer in Damian Jacobs, who's, you know, a one technique, kind of a nose, kind of a run stuffing guy. And they missed out on another huge guy like that, Vicesio Salt, who was 340-pound, you know, mammoth that would have filled that role perfectly. So, like you said, I think that's the biggest weakness for them is depth on the interior. You just don't have it. Omar Hunter is going to be your starting nose tackle. And, I mean, His line mates made fun of him at the beginning of the year for his Chick-fil-A love handles, and I think that's not the only thing with him that's probably soft. So,
yikes.
I like Omar as a person. I really do. I think he's
the best interview on the team.
Yeah, he's a great person to talk to. He's a great guy, but he just doesn't have that you know, ferocious tenacity inside that you need at that position.
Yeah, I mean, I think just based on weight alone, I kind of put him and Leon Orr at the nose spot, but that's not ideal. And again, like we said, with the guys who are the penetrators, I don't see it either. And I think it was funny because coming into the year, I thought that the kind of the strength would be these defensive tackles, and that if you play the 3-4, you can get guys like, you can get Howard and Hunter and Easley and Floyd kind of rotating around in there, and they can do a lot of damage, but over the course of the season, it was clear that they just don't have enough guys to keep them fresh, and it really wore them down and was a problem. if they can't find a major way to fix that, especially with Howard leaving, and I don't have the numbers on this. I don't think anybody counted it. But he might have played the most snaps of all those guys. He was out there a lot. And so, the depth concerns are even bigger than they were this season.
The biggest issue, I think, hands down, is that defensive end spot. They've got to find a way to get Shreve Floyd inside. I think that'd probably be my number one thing if I'm Will Muschamp this offseason, is find a way to do that, because it really looked all season like he was out of position. You put him back at tackle, and I think he had a sack and a half on the first drive of the Gator Bowl. So he needs to be back inside of that defensive tackle spot, or else it really could just be another wasted year for him. They've got to find a way to do that. If it's Bullard, I think it could be. He's a guy that physically, I think, is about 250 pounds. He's not like the speed rusher, but he's a really complete defensive end that plays the run really well too. It could be him. I don't really know. They've got to find another guy that can go opposite of Ronald Powell, or else it really comes down to playing a lot of 3-4, like you said, and I think that's really probably the route that they'll choose to go here.
The problem with getting Shreve Floyd inside more is that he and Easley both play the 3 technique.
That's
so
true.
When you have Floyd on the field, you're not going to have Easley on the field. I mean, you could, but then you got 2 defensive tackles both playing the 3 technique, and that's all going to work in kind of passing downs. It's not going to work against the run. So...
Right, I think that if you play 3-4, you can use Floyd at 3-4 end, and he's not that bad because that's more of a penetrating kind of thing than the speed rush around the edge they're trying to do in the 4-3.
Well, the 3-4 end is more actually you want a guy stand up that can hold the edge. And
right, right,
edge
and he
rush.
But he's a taller guy with the longer arms that can kind of lock out like that and set the
Easley
edge in that way too. Floyd.
Yeah, okay, you said Easley.
So he can work both ways on that spot, whereas
Floyd definitely
Easley definitely cannot.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like Easley's a better fit at 4-3 end than Floyd is?
Yeah, I think so, too. I don't understand.
I think that's the move I would have made, is flip those two, but I don't get paid millions of dollars. So
I
don't.
I mean, he's definitely got a faster jump,
yeah,
faster get off, you know, more electricity as a rusher than Floyd does. I agree with you completely. I don't know why they did that.
And then, I mean, just while we're on that point, when I laid out the 4-3 ends, it's Ronald Powell and Kedrick Johnson on one side, and then Shreve Floyd, Earl Okine, and Tevin Westbrook on the other side. Like, this is... And if you want to move Floyd inside, now you're starting Earl Okine or Kedrick Johnson? Like, what? Like, how did this happen?
Right, exactly. That's where, you know, you're going to have to start either an incoming freshman or, you know, play a lot of 3-4. The defensive line, I mean, they've still got 7 positions open in their class, and I think that they've got to be targeting at least 3 defensive linemen with those recruits. I think they've got to.
Anyway, kind of last thing I want to note on this is that name we haven't said yet today, Michael Taylor. I think if you do play more 3-4, you get more snaps for him, and that's always a good thing because I thought he played very well in his limited time this season.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think that's why 3-4 makes so much sense, is because you said that you're most confident with that linebacker spot and the depth that they have there. To get all those guys on the field and get them more snaps, that's the way you got to do it, and you got to figure out a way to get him in there. And I thought Kitchens played fairly well before his injury. So you've got depth at that linebacker spot, whereas if you play that 3-4, you get more of them on the field.
And they've got a couple guys coming in there as well. We won't talk too much about that. But I agree. Michael Taylor showed some very, very good things this year. He's one of those guys that you get him going straight ahead. He's just downhill tackler, and he hits the hole with force, and he hits the ball carrier with force. And that's something that you didn't really see out of, you know, Jelani Jenkins, John Bostic. They're solid players, but they don't have that mean streak to them that I think Michael Taylor could develop.
That's a solid point to me. Anyway, to talk more about some of these recruiting guys and guys we have coming in, hopefully – for Florida's sake, in the as of signing day, which is February 1st. I want to have Brian Holt and Kelly Price, our recruiting writer, Kelly, and Brian Holt, who's working for which one? I get all the online sites mixed up. I feel really bad about
inside,
it. Like it's my job to know this kind of thing.
Inside,
I think he's inside the Gators.
He works for Cody's rival over here at Rivals.
Right. Okay. So anyway, we're going to try to get those two in here to talk a little recruiting. Maybe we'll have Cody back for that. But that's just something to tease for the coming days. And I mean, I guess that wraps up kind of my season recap, look ahead, returning players, Gator Bowl, Peace Hire stuff. Do you guys have anything else on this? All right, with that, we're about ready to move into our weekly awards. We have the Ahmad Black Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport and the Will Hill Awful Life Decision of the Week. We always end the show on a bad note, so we will start with the Ahmads, and we'll let Cody start us off.
All right, as far as the good things, that's what the Ahmads are, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
First time Ahmad and Will
giver
here. You'll
forgive me. For the sake of the University of Florida, it's a good thing that it's almost baseball season. And my argument is because it hasn't been a great year for the athletic program as a whole. So they need some optimism. So you have a preseason number one team in the country.
You think people are really that optimistic about the baseball team?
Oh, I don't think anybody cares. but I think it's good for the athletic program as a whole.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not one that follows the college baseball that much, but I think if you're a Florida baseball fan, you probably just figure they're going to blow it in the World Series again or something like that.
Like they did one year. I mean, that's kind of a small sample size there.
I'm just saying. But just saying.
I know that the four Florida baseball fans out there don't feel that way. All four of them. All
right.
And for oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Do we go horrible? Are we doing them together?
No, you do good ones, and then we go through the bad ones after that. So we'll kick it over to Matt Watts for his Imad.
All right, it's been a little while since I've, injected some Jaguars homerism into my Imad.
Yeah, we made it through yesterday's show without it. Right. I was impressed.
And since the big news in Jaguars, related news recently is the hiring of Mike Mularkey as head coach, I'm going to give my Imad to Justin Blackmon, wide receiver from Oklahoma State.
It's a little ad for the Jaguars if you're paying attention.
That's just because I'm not sold on the Mike Mularkey hire. But Justin Blackmon.
How could you be?
Yeah, right. Absolutely balled out this year. Completely showed everybody why in the Rose Bowl that, came in with the inner thigh infection. It might be the creepiest explanation ever. But he straight balled out and showed why he should be the Jaguars' number 7 pick in the draft, should he be there.
All right, I mean, I like that. Makes sense to me. All right, mine goes to, and I can't believe I missed this on the basketball show, but I'm going to give a shout-out to Chandler Parsons, who is doing big things in the NBA right now.
Hold on. Can we also mention Corey Brewer last night?
What did he do?
It was either last night or the night before. He had 17 points in the second quarter alone.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know he had 17 points in, a season.
He had 19 points for the game.
He's streaky.
right.
But he had 17 in the second quarter, which was the tie for the most in the NBA this season.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Wow. As long as we're talking Gators in the NBA, before we get back to Parsons, Al Horford had some shoulder thing. Hopefully he's going to be okay.
Just torn pectoral muscle out for 3 to 4 months.
All right, he's not going to be okay. Anyway. but yeah, Parsons. He's been getting the starts the last couple nights, which is weird because on Houston they have a lot of solid players and you didn't think he would rise up that quickly. But he's been getting a ton of minutes. Last night, 8 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, a block, and 3 steals, and no turnovers. And then the night before that, 20 points, 7 rebounds. A steal and only 1 turnover. So, I mean, good work for Chandler Parsons. Just want to give him a shout-out. All right, switch over to the Wills. Cody, start us off again.
Yeah, mine is just LSU as a whole. I know that's really not a... it didn't take me long to come up with that one.
They earned it.
They really did. So congratulations to them for just being completely terrible. And for the Alabama fan base last night for cheering them as their basketball team dribbled the ball over midcourt.
Yeah,
that was really
awesome.
Well planned out. I don't know who thought about that, but that's brilliant.
Yeah, if you guys have not seen that highlight, go YouTube that because it's worth it. It's very funny. For me, my Will Hill, it's kind of a season Will Hill since that was kind of the preconceived notion for
I like that.
For this award, so it ended up, didn't end up being that way. But awful life decision goes to Will Muschamp for sprinting around Ben Hill Griffin Stadium in week 3 after the Gators beat the Tennessee Volunteers, which were probably the absolute worst team in the SEC this year. But he sprinted around, fist pumped, celebrated like the Gators had just won the national championship. So, Coach Boone, if you're listening, Will Hill, awful life decision goes out to you.
No, you know what? You know what? I'm going to raise you one. Mine, I had one planned and I'm changing it. Mine is going to go to Trey Burton, who after the Kentucky game said they were bringing the swagger back to Gainesville. That's the Will Hill awful life decision of the year. There's absolutely no question that is the most ridiculous thing.
We have a winner.
To then finish 6-6.
Have a winner.
Scrape out a mediocre bowl win. Just bringing the swagger back to Gainesville. That's what we didn't hear a lot from him after that.
Nope, sure didn't.
Well, I mean, it was that, and then he called out the LSU secondary, and then we were done with Trey Burton for the year. But
did he say after that, or was that before that, that he said he didn't know what his major was?
Wow, yeah, he had a lot of highlight moments this season. I wonder what happened to that. Apparently, a lot of people are getting shoehorned in the family and community sciences major. I'm waiting for the big investigative report to drop, but...
Yeah, I mean...
It's true.
Who was it that said they wanted to be a business major, and they said, nah, you can't do that. You gotta be a family youth.
Right, yeah. It's like, they don't want them to do things that are hard. It takes too much time.
That's probably why Jordan Jenkins didn't come to Florida. He wanted to be an engineering major. They're like, no.
No, we wouldn't let you do that. No, I'm sorry. Wow. Alright, well, that about wraps up the show for this season, I guess. We'll be coming to you with a lot of basketball stuff and hopefully that recruiting thing, like I said. But, yeah, that's a football season. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Hopefully we illuminated your football watching experience. Again, you can follow us on Twitter for more nuggets of football greatness, because I'm sure news will continue through the offseason. We are at Alligator Sports. I'm at Greg Luca.
I'm at Watt Matts, WATTMATTS.
And then, Cody, you can tell them where to find you, and you can talk about Fighting Gators, which is yours, right?
That's true.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I'm Fightin' at Gators. C. Jones Scout, and FightingGators.com. It's a little bit of everything, football, basketball, baseball, recruiting and message board are kind of the lifeblood of the site, and a lot of people like that kind of stuff, so... Signing day, less than a month away. All sorts of recruiting information there as well.
Is that one of the subscription ones?
It is.
But there's free stuff? Or
not really.
Kids, ask your mom for an increase in your allowance.
Exactly. It's, like 10 bucks a month, I think.
And Christmas present, whatever.
It's like 33 cents a day, right? I think that's like the average. That's how you got to look at it.
For Cody, it's worth it.
Yeah, if you heard his dreamy voice on the podcast and you just couldn't get enough,
that
make
is
sure you
true.
Sign up so you can interact with them firsthand on the message board.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. And we know that's what happened.
And you could send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org. You could find us on facebook.com/alligator podcast. Also, one quick note I want to make. If you go on iTunes and go to download this podcast, it's probably only going to download today's because it only does like the last one. So, I mean, go back and get yesterday's, too, because there's all your basketball stuff in there, and you haven't listened to us for a while, so you can handle two in a week. So just a heads up on that one, and I guess we'll be with you whenever I do the recruiting thing, whenever I get that together. Still waiting to get my laptop back, so, I mean, I got my own issues, but hopefully we can get a recruiting podcast going, and then we'll be back with basketball next week one way or the other.
In the show, Luca!
So until then, thanks for listening.